Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is November the 30th. We are in Sefer Ezra, and we are beginning Perek Daled, Chapter 4. We left off with the Jews had come back to Eretz Yisrael. Over 40,000 Jews came back, and they gathered in Yerushalayim in the beginning of Tishrei, and they began to bring karbonos. And that process went on, and then they also began to gather the materials together to build the Beis HaMikdash. They are thinking that they will be able to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash completely. We know, in retrospect, that they will not be able to finish. They will only be able to put down the foundation, and then they will be stopped. Here, in Perek Daled, in Chapter 4, we will read how the work was stopped. So we're going to attempt to do the whole Perek tonight. We'll see how far we can get. Vayishmu Tzare Yehuda uBenyamin. And those who were against, those who were antagonists of Yehuda and Binyamin heard, ki v'nei ha'gola bonim heichal la'Hashem Elokei Yisrael, that the people of the galus, of the exile, were building a sanctuary for Hashem, the God of Israel. Vayigishu el Zerubbabel vel Rashi Ha'avos. So they came to Zerubbabel and to the heads of the families. Vayomru lahem, and they said to them, Nivne imachem, let us build with you. Ki chachem nidrosh le'lokechem, because like you, we seek out your God. V'lo anachnu zovchim, and to him we serve, we worship. Mimei Esar Chadon Melech Ashur, from the days of Esar Chadon, the king of Assyria, Hamare Osanu Po, that brought us up to here. So these antagonists of the Jews, that's what they're called, they are the non-Jews living in the area around Yerushalayim and Shomron, and they are asking to participate in the building of the Beis HaMikdash. And they're saying, because we also serve your God. Vayomer lahem Zerubbabel v'Yeshua. So Zerubbabel and Yeshua said to them, U'sha'ar Rashi Ha'avos l'Yisrael, and all the other heads of the families of Yisrael, the fathers of Yisrael, Lo lachem v'lanu livnos beis le'lokeinu. It is not for you and for us to build the house to our God. Meaning, it is not something we can do with you. Ki anachnu yachad nivne la'Hashem Elokei Yisrael. We together, means we Jews together, will build to Hashem, the God of Yisrael. Kasher tzivanu, as he commanded, Kasher tzivanu ha'melech koresh melech paras. Like the king Koresh, the king of Persia, commanded us. So they rejected the help of these people. Vayihi am ha'aretz mirapim yedei am Yehuda. So the am ha'aretz, the people of the land, meaning the non-Jews, weakened the hand of the nation of Yehuda. Umevahalim osam livnos. And they were confounding them, confusing them to build, meaning making it difficult for them to build. And they hired about them advisors to undermine their rapport with the king. Kol yimei Koresh melech paras, all the days of Koresh, the king of Persia. Ve'ad malchus Daryavesh melech paras, until the days of Daryavesh, the king of Persia. From the days of Koresh, the king of Persia, he's the one who authorized the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash. He's going to be succeeded by Achashverosh of the Purim story, who will then be succeeded by Daryavesh, the son of Achashverosh and Esther. So from the time of Koresh, the king of Paras, the king of Persia, these people are going to undermine the building of the Beis HaMikdash, and that will go all the way through the reign of Achashverosh, all the way till the reign of Daryavesh, the son of Achashverosh and Esther. Ulmachus Achashverosh, and in the kingdom of Achashverosh, Beschilas Malchuso, in the beginning of his reign, Kasvu Sitna al Yoshve Yehuda of Yerushalayim, they wrote a Sitna. Sitna comes from the word Satan. They wrote a damaging report on those who dwelled in Yehuda and Yerushalayim. And we're going to now read what the damaging note was, or at least a form of it, in a moment. So, if one reads these psukim, one reads these verses, one gets the impression that they were beginning to build, and the nations around them wanted to participate in the building of the Beis HaMikdash, and they offered their help, and they even said, "We also worship your God." And the Jews rejected the help of the non-Jews around them. As a result, the non-Jews around them became bitter and undermined the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash. And they did get it stopped, as we will see. And that lasted through the reign of Achashverosh all the way till the son of Achashverosh and Esther. It's 18 years that the building gets stopped. That's what one would think when reading it. But in fact, it's really there's much more going on than that. We have to know, who are these people who are living in and around Yerushalayim who want to participate in the building of the Beis HaMikdash? So this goes back to the time of Sancheriv, the king of Ashur. They themselves reference I'm just trying to find the name. Esarhaddon, the king of Ashur. So we have to go back to Sancheriv, the king of Ashur. Sancheriv was the one who took the 10 tribes into exile. Now, Sancheriv, the king of Ashur, was in his day the most powerful king in the world, and he controlled nearly the entire world. He conquered all of the known world, which means, again, when we say he conquered, it doesn't mean that he necessarily annexed the entire world to Assyria, but it means that he had control. All of the other kingdoms had to own up to him. They had to pay taxes to him, and if he said jump, they said how high. They were under his control. He controlled nearly the whole world. When the Gemara says, I've mentioned to you before, the Gemara says that four kings were Malach Bekipa. They ruled the entire dome of the world, which means the entire known world. The Gemara asks, wasn't there a fifth one? Wasn't there Sancheriv? And the Gemara says, nearly. Sancheriv nearly controlled the whole world. He never got his hands on Yerushalayim. That was his downfall. When he attempted to conquer Yerushalayim, that's when Chizkiyahu was the king. Chizkiyahu was an incredible tzaddik. And when Sancheriv attempted to conquer Yerushalayim, Hashem listened to Chizkiyahu's davening and sent a malach, he sent an angel that decimated Sancheriv's massive army, and that was the end of Sancheriv. But until that point, he was an incredibly powerful king. As I said, he's the one who took into exile the 10 tribes. When he did that, he left a barren land. He came into the northern kingdom of Israel, which was not the kingdom of Yehuda, it was the kingdom of the 10 tribes. It did not include Yerushalayim, but it was the area to the north of Yerushalayim. And the capital was Shomron. And he conquered them, and he took the people and physically dragged them off into Golus, into exile. And they have not returned. When he did that, because the land was barren, he took other nations and brought them to that area and settled them in that area. The Gemara says Sancheriv was mevalbel es kol ha'umos. He mixed up all the nations. He didn't just do this in Eretz Yisrael. He did this wherever he conquered. His system of dominion was conquer a nation and take the people out and put them elsewhere, and take other people and put them there. But in doing so, he made everybody out of sorts. He took everybody out of their element. No one was on their home turf. It was a way that Sennacherib exercised control over everybody. And it was very difficult then to mount a rebellion against Sennacherib because no one felt comfortable. No one knew the lay of the land in their new surroundings. And this is what he did. He moved everybody around. The Gemara says that because of this, it is from his time and on that we're not sure who's who amongst the nations of the world. That's why we cannot identify who Amalek is, for example. We can't identify who those non-Jews are who, for example, are not acceptable as converts, like the men of Moab and the men of Ammon, who, if they do convert, they cannot marry a regular Jewess. We don't know who they are, because Sennacherib mixed everybody up. And therefore, when a man converts, we have to use the rule of rove, of majority, and we presume every convert is not from Moab and from Ammon, because we don't know. That's because of Sennacherib. Sennacherib mixed everybody up, so Moab is no longer living in the historical area of Moab. Ammon is no longer living in the historical area of Ammon. And same goes for all of the nations. So we don't know who's who. When he brought people to the area of Shomron and settled them there, so we know that Sennacherib was given the power to conquer the 10 tribes because the 10 tribes were sinning. It says so in the Psukim, in the verses in Yeshaya, and in Malachim, and in Divrei Hayamim, wherever it's reported in Navi, this story of Sennacherib, it's reported that the northern kingdom were sinning, and they did not have the benefit that the southern kingdom had, where every few years in the southern kingdom, we did have some evil kings, but we also had some very good kings, and the people fluctuated between not being so great to being excellent. In the northern kingdom, it was a downhill road the whole way. And they spiraled further and further away from HaKadosh Baruch Hu until Hashem brought Sennacherib against them, conquered them, and dragged them off to exile. So we know that his ability to conquer the northern kingdom, the kingdom of Yisrael, was because of their sins. But when he brought others to live in their place, that was something that he did on his own. And that Hashem did not tolerate. And in Sefer Malachim, in the Book of Kings, when the story is reported, so the pasuk says, the verse says, I am in Malachim Beis, it's the second part of Malachim of Kings, and I'm in Perikyud Zion, chapter 17. And it says here that when he brought these nations from all over the place to Shomron, it says in Pasuk Chavei, verse 25, Vayihi bischilas shivtam sham. It was when they initially dwelled there. Lo yaru es Hashem. They did not fear Hashem. Vayishalach Hashem bohem es ha'arayos. And Hashem sent against them the lions. Vayuhargim bohem. And the lions were killing them. They were being mauled by lions. Those that were caused to be settled in those areas of Shomron. Hashem brought against them lions. Vayomu lemelech Ashur lemor, they said to the king of Ashur, saying, Hagoyim Ashur higlisa, those nations that the nations that you took into exile, Batoshev ba'ore Shomron, and you put them to dwell in the cities of Shomron, lo yadu es mishpat elokei ha'aretz, they don't know the laws of the gods of that land. Vayeshalach b'mes ha'arayos, and the god, or the gods, have sent against them the lions. V'hinam mimi simosam, and they are killing us. They talked about themselves in third person. They're killing them. Kasha enam yodim es mishpat elokei ha'aretz, because they don't know the laws of the god of that land. The non-Jews who are placed in Shomron recognized that the reason why this highly unusual event was happening, that they were being attacked by lions, was because they didn't know how to serve the Jewish God. Which is a fascinating thing. They understood that this was supernatural, that the lions were after them. They understood this was not something happens. Well, sometimes a lion attacks. It was completely unnatural that this should be happening, which means either that there were normally no lions there, or if there were, now there were an abundance of them, or even if there were always an abundance of them, they didn't normally come into the populated areas, and now they were coming into the populated areas. Whatever it was clearly a departure from what is considered normal, and they recognized that it must be that they were violating whatever the laws of this land are supposed to be. So they complained to Sanherib. They didn't have the mobility to leave because Sanherib put people in places and told them you got to stay there. So they couldn't leave. And they complained to Sanherib, what are we supposed to do? So I'm reading to you again from Malachim, from Kings. Vayitzav melech Ashur lemor, the king of Ashur commanded, saying, Holichu shama echad mehakanim asher higlisem misham. Bring there one of the priests that you took into exile from there. Meaning one of the Jewish Kohanim that you took from there. V'yelchu v'yeshvu sham. They'll go and they will dwell there. V'yoreim es mishpat alokei haaretz. And he will show them the laws of the God of the land. He'll tell them how to do it. And that's what it says they did. And one of the Kohanim came that had been exiled from Shomron. And he dwelled in Beis-El. And he showed them how to fear God. There was a problem, though. This Kohen that they brought was from the people that they exiled. The people that they exiled were not serving Hashem properly. So this Kohen, although he was a Jewish Kohen, and although he certainly knew something of the Torah, but he himself was not a tzaddik. He was one of the ones who wasn't serving Hashem properly. So Sanherib brought somebody who was a Jew who would know the laws of the land, but he himself was not faithful to the laws of the land. So the psukim go on over here. I'm not going to read them all to you. The psukim go on and explain that he continued to teach them, although he did talk about Hashem, but he did not stop them from worshiping their own gods and from their own Avodah Zarah, from their paganism. And so in the end, we ended up with a very strange situation. You had non-Jews living in Shomron, and it says that they did serve Hashem to an extent. And the Pasuk says in Pasuk Lamigol, verse 33, as Hashem hayu yireim, they feared Hashem, v'as Eloheim hayu ovdim, and they served their gods. K'mishpat hagoyim asher higlu asam misham, just like the Jews who had been exiled from there. They ended up copying what the 10 tribes had been doing until that point, where they did believe in Hashem to a certain extent, and did but serve Hashem to a certain extent, but they also serve their pagan gods. That's what they did. When the Jews acted that way, they ended up going into exile. When the non-Jews acted that way, that did stop the lions. The lions stopped attacking, and they stayed there. And these people are in the area of Shomron from this time all the way through until the first Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, and then all the way through until the time that Zerubbabel and Yehoshua Kohen Gadol have led the Jews up to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. They're still there, these people, who are worshipping Hashem and worshipping pagan gods at the same time. There is a discussion in the Gemara, amongst the sages of the Gemara, what is the status of these people? They are called the Kusim. And what is the status of the Kusim? Are they Geirei Emes? Are they true converts? Or are they Geirei Arayos? Or are they the converts of lions, which means they are not true converts? Everybody agrees that they converted out of fear, out of coercion. They were afraid of the lions. The question is, how sincere was their conversion? And this is a debate in the Gemara. It is an unresolved debate that some sages are of the opinion that they are true converts, and some are of the opinion that they're not. What difference does it make? In the time of this debate, which is in the time of the Mishnayos, they weren't religious Jews. they kept some laws. It was an interesting situation. It was a group of non-Jews, a group of Kusim, with these people, who did not marry into the mainstream Jews. They kept for themselves, and the Jews kept away from them. So they were their own group, and they kept certain laws very carefully. The Gemara says that the laws that the Kusim kept, they kept even more carefully and more stringently than the Jews did. The ones that they latched onto, they kept very, very strongly. But they didn't keep all the laws. So whether they were true converts or not didn't affect their religious status. They were not fully religious. The question, though, is that, first of all, if one of them wants to become fully religious, do they need to convert? Because if they already are converts, they don't need to convert. If they're not yet converts, then they need to convert. That's number one. Number two, if in fact they were converts, then it's a big problem because they were not keeping the laws of marriage and divorce properly. And you know what happens when Jews don't keep marriage and divorce properly? You end up, God forbid, with mamzerim, with illegitimate children. And they can't marry regular Jews. Whereas if they weren't Jewish, then the fact that they weren't keeping Jewish laws of marriage and divorce is irrelevant. So it matters whether these people were considered Jewish or not Jewish. Be that as it may, in the time of the Gemara, they discovered that these Kusim were worshipping an image of a Yonah, of a dove, on one of the mountains, and the sages proclaimed that irrespective of what their status really was, whether they were or weren't converts, from now on they are treated as non-Jews, because their behavior was such that Jews should not have anything to do with them. And that was the decree of the sages. So for all intents and purposes, they are treated as non-Jews. But there is a discussion about these lions, whether that made that caused them to convert sincerely or not. There is such a discussion about that amongst the sages. Just as an aside, I don't want to get sidetracked into this, but you see that just because you find a group of people that keeps certain laws that are from our Torah does not prove that they are of Jewish ancestry. You do find this anomaly where you find certain groups of people that adopted certain practices. It does not prove that they were Jewish.
Yeah. Why worshiping a dove on a mountain? Why is that worse than whatever else they were doing?
I'm not sure. That's a good question. I'm not sure why that was the straw that broke the camel's back. It was being done in secret. I don't know exactly what they were doing differently then. But at that point, already the sages just said, that's enough.
Maybe the Jewish people were thought to be more vulnerable at that
point. That could be as well. It could be that it wasn't just their practice, it was also our vulnerability. That's very possible. I don't know. But at any rate, we'll get to your question in a moment. So that is the people that we're talking about over here who came to assist in the building of the Beis HaMikdash. Yes?
Wasn't that after the Yitzhar, the Lord's desire was already removed?
Yeah, but the Gemara says even after the inclination for Avodah Zarah, for paganism, was removed, the non-Jews still did it. They still do it today.
So then you could say that obviously they're Goyim because they didn't do it anymore.
The Gemara says why do they still do it if there's no draw to do it? The Gemara says Ma'is Avosem Biyadem. They're just copying what their ancestors did. So anybody whose ancestors did it, they still do it. It doesn't prove whether they're Jewish or not Jewish. What's that?
Jews also did it.
Yeah, but not in the same way. We didn't do it as a fervent practice.
Huh.
So, yeah.
What constitutes an illegitimate child? Is it also considered illegitimate if it's a Jewish person who marries a non-Jew?
No, that's not called illegitimate. At least not.
Yeah, I'm trying to see.
There are different opinions about
what was the line drawn.
Yeah, there are different opinions about that. But I'll tell you where everybody agrees. Everybody agrees that a child born out of incest or adultery
right.
is illegitimate. Out of wedlock is not illegitimate. Jew and non-Jew, according to most opinions, is not illegitimate. So that
I didn't know if there was some kind of special idea about that.
No, there is. Mamzer is essentially the, if you want to know the technical definition that we rule with, it's a debate in the Gemara. The technical definition is the union that would result in the punishment of kares, mm-hmm. of being cut off from the Jewish people. A child born of that union is a mamzer, is illegitimate. So that would include incest and adultery.
Okay.
So that's the technical definition.
Would it include children of other forbidden relationships? Or are you calling all those forbidden relationships incest?
Most of those forbidden relationships have the punishment of kares.
Yeah.
So anything that has the punishment of kares...
So it's not just incest as we understand it, but it's all forbidden relationships.
Well, it's what the Torah calls incest.
So
brother and sister.
Are called incest?
Yeah. Brother and sister, parent and child...
all those other
unions
that are listed.
Yeah, all the other ones that are listed over there that we read on Yom Kippur in the afternoon.
Right.
On Yom Kippur. The only exception to that is the prohibition of nida, of a woman who is impure. A person's wife, even though she may be impure, and there is within that category of punishment, but it still does not cause an illegitimate child.
Are there two sisters in that category in that list?
Yeah, that would be in that list. That's not kares. That's not kares.
But it's in the list.
Yeah, but it doesn't say kares over there.
Okay.
Right.
Well, does that rule upheld today? Like,
I just want to make sure, because this is forever and ever and ever, it's being recorded. So I just want to say I don't have a chumash in front of me, but if I remember correctly, it's not in that list. Yeah.
I don't know if we'll have that tape, but if somebody's a rape victim, is that child still upheld as 10 years or whatever?
It doesn't matter how it happened. Remember, the child didn't do anything.
Right.
This is not a punishment to the child. It's a status in order to maintain the purity of the line of the Jewish people. It's not a question of... It's not. What's that?
But it is a punishment.
No, it's definitely something which the child is compromised. But it's not a punishment to the child.
I hear you. So what happens to that child that wants to marry a Jew?
They can't. They can't marry a regular Jew. They have to marry another mamzeres, or they can marry a convert.
So we know who those people are?
If we know. Sometimes, unfortunately, it does happen. Unfortunately. Usually when it happens today, those who are made aware of it keep it quiet, and they just, file it away for future need. But, we hope it never happens, but unfortunately it does.
Is that for a lifetime or for 10 years?
It's forever.
For a lifetime?
It's forever. Yeah. you see the consequences of a person's actions. They can destroy another human being.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What if the same child converts to Judaism? Can convert?
Only a Jewish child would be a mamzer, would be illegitimate.
Okay.
They already are Jewish.
All right, there already are. Okay,
right.
So you're not talking about
Jewish mother.
All right.
Right. Now, these are the people that came to Zerubbabel and offered their help. Now, these people were not interested in there being a Beis HaMikdash. They didn't want the Jews rebuilding. When they offered their help, what they wanted to do was to infiltrate the building of the builders and be involved in the building so that they could sabotage the building as it went, mm-hmm. as it went along. You'll notice, please take a look back in Ezra, what we have in front of us. Look very carefully. If you're using in English, look at the Hebrew side. In Pasuk Beis, in verse 2, where they come to offer their services. I'm going to read it again in the Hebrew side. I'm going to stop on the word that I want you to notice. Vayikshu el Zerubbabel vel Rashi Ha'avos. They came before Zerubbabel and the heads of the fathers. Vayomru lahem, and they said to them, Nivna imachem, let us build with you. Ki chachem nidrosh lelokechem, because like you, we seek out your God. Velo anachnu zovchim, and to him we offer sacrifices. The word velo is spelled vav lamed aleph. It is read as vav lamed vav because the word lo could mean to him, and the word lo can mean no or not. There's a double meaning here. They were saying velo and to him with a vav, anachnu zovchim, we offer sacrifices. But the way that it is written, it is velo anachnu zovchim, and we do not offer sacrifices with an olive. We do not offer sacrifices to Hashem. They were speaking with a forked tongue. They were saying one thing, but they meant something else. And that's what the Navi, that's what the Prophet is writing over here, to draw our attention to the fact that they were out to sabotage. They were trying to infiltrate their ranks. Zerubbabel and Yehoshua, Kohen Gadol, and the heads of the families saw through them and did not let them join. Nevertheless, they attempted to stop the work through other means, and that was by trying to hire advisors to go to the king of Persia and undermine the work and to get it stopped. And they finally are successful. So after the foundation is laid, which goes on for a while, but after that happens, they do undermine the work, they do get it stopped, and it remains stopped all the way through the reign of Achashverosh until the time of Esther's son, Dariavesh. Yes?
Koresh sent all these people and money and people. Did he ever go to actually see what was happening?
Doesn't say that he ever did, and it's hard to believe that he would have. It's unlikely that he did. And you're right, you bring up an excellent point that he authorized this massive immigration to Israel. And this bunch of people with the money and the materials and the musicians and the whole business, to get him to reverse his decree was work. The Tsar Yehuda, the antagonists of the Jews, had to send emissaries to the king, and they had to whisper in his ear, and they had to talk about, they had to use insinuation, and they had to be very crafty. They couldn't just come before him and say, "Yeah, the Jews are terrible people." You'd say, "Go jump in a lake." Or better yet, cut your head off.
You know, would send a trusted advisor to see what's going on, what's the real story out there, or go himself something?
I'm sure he did. And I'm sure they either intercepted it or, they managed to build a case. That's what they did. That's what it means in Pasuk Hei, verse 5, V'sochrim aleihem yoatzim. They hired upon them advisors. The word yoatz, they didn't have this in those days, but we would use the word lawyers. That they got people who could build a case against the Jewish people. And that's what they did. They built a case. And it took time, it took effort, it took money, and they managed, through building a case, to get the work stopped. Yeah?
So these people lived there, right?
They lived in Shomron, which is to the north of Jerusalem.
No. So was this a developed city, a developed... I mean, where
they lived was developed, yeah.
So meaning they had water, agriculture.
I assume they did. They were living there.
So what was the reason they thought that if we had the Beis HaMikdash once again, that we would be powerful and we would throw them out?
It's possibly that, or it's just straight anti-Semitism. They didn't like Jews. They didn't like the whole idea of worshiping Hashem. You know, we will see that there's a very prominent member of the Shomronim, as they are called, a very prominent member, whose name is, we'll get to him very shortly, but his name is Shimshai. And Rashi tells us that Shimshai had a father who is rather famous in the Purim story, or infamous. Haman. He was one of Haman's sons, was there as one of the spokesmen for these people. So they were not friends of the Jews.
It's so wonderful that we said no.
Right.
Finally, we said no.
Well, the Gemara derives from here. The Gemara does not criticize Zerubbabel and Yehoshua for not allowing them to join the work. You know, if it were true that because they didn't let them in, that's why they started up, then the Gemara would have criticized. The Gemara does not criticize them. Instead, the Gemara derives from here that although we are allowed to take materials, to buy materials, to ask the non-Jews to help in bringing materials for the building of the Beis HaMikdash, but the actual construction must be done by Jews, not by non-Jews. It's derived from here. Lo lachem v'lanu. It is not for you and us together to build. Hashem's house has to be built by us alone.
But doesn't Herod build?
Yeah, but Herod was the king. No one could stop him. But he did it.
God could have stopped
him. Yeah, God could have stopped him. God didn't stop him. Anyway, he didn't build it anew. It was falling apart, and he fixed it up.
That's so non Jews allowed to fix it up.
I don't know if he did it by hand. I don't know who he hired to do it. He was the king who authorized it. I'm sure he didn't get his hand dirty.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, right. As Hashem, we'll talk about this. We'll see if we'll have a chance. As I mentioned at the outset, I'm going to have a Hanukkah class on the first night of Hanukkah, and it's going to be about construction and refurbishing a shul. And it's based on the Hanukkah story, which includes that. So we'll see if we get to that. At any rate, these people of Shomron are the Samaritans. The term Good Samaritan is a Christian term. It is not a Jewish term. And we would not call them Good Samaritans. We would call them Evil Samaritans.
Exactly.
Because that's what they were. And these are the people that we're talking about. And they stopped the work of the Beis HaMikdash.
Well, doesn't the term Good Samaritan mean that there are bad Samaritans?
Yeah, well, I guess so. I don't know. That's
not what's meant by it.
Right,
that's
not what's meant by it.
That sounds, from what I remember of geography, Samaria was huge. It was a very big country. Wasn't Samaria?
I don't think, yeah.
Yeah, that area, wasn't that very big?
I don't know. Can't tell you.
What are we talking about here in date time? B.C. what?
I it's always hard for me to extrapolate it out. That we're talking
before
about...
Well
before the point. In this story itself?
Right.
This story itself happens... what can I tell you? Four...
After the destruction of the first Beis.
Yeah, we're talking roughly 400 years before the Common Era. A little less than that. Somewhere in there. Now, you know from the Purim story that Esther goes before Ahasuerus, and she tells them that she has a request, and he says to her, "Whatever you want, ad chatzi ha-malchus v'inas ha-malchus, until half the kingdom." So what does that mean?
Now
that it's
right, Israel.
So right, well, not the base. So the Mefarshim, the Gemara says that when he says until half the kingdom, he says you can have anything you want up to, but not including the Beis HaMikdash. Ahasuerosh, one of the platforms of his not candidacy, but his royalty, of his kingship, was that the Beis HaMikdash will not be rebuilt. As you see, as it says here in Pasuk Vav in verse 6, in the kingdom of Ahasuerosh, in the beginning of his kingdom, they wrote a sitna. They wrote how do we translate that before?
They say calumny. Accusation.
Accusation, okay.
Damaging report.
On those who dwelled in Yehuda and Yerushalayim. The work was being stopped. There is a debate amongst the commentaries whether the work was stopped while Koresh was still king, or whether it was only undermined but wasn't actually stopped until Ahasuerus took office and then he stopped it. There is a debate amongst the Mefarshim. Rashi understands the work already stopped in the last year of Koresh's reign. Koresh only reigned 3 years. So at the end of Koresh's reign, he stopped the work, and then Ahasuerus simply reinforced that by saying, absolutely not, it will not be rebuilt. Others understand that, no, that Koresh didn't actually stop it, but it was being undermined, and then in time of Ahasuerus, then it got stopped.
What kind of time frame is this?
From when?
From the time that it stopped, from the time that it's begun, until the time that it stopped.
So that depends on...
And then from the time that it stopped, the time that...
Right, it stopped for 18 years. From the time that it started till it stopped was, I think it was under a year. From the time, and it depends what you call starting, because they took time to gather material, and then they started building. So I'm not sure exactly what we're going to call the starting time, but it wasn't that much time. that they were working on it, and then it was stopped. But it was stopped in stages. It was this thing where it was this, they were undermining it. So, you know, there was probably shortages, you know, that they needed more of this and more of that, and they weren't able to get it because the bureaucracy was getting harder to deal with, where when they first went up, they, you know, they cut through all the red tape. But once this campaign started to stop them, then it got harder and harder. So it was probably this thing where it kind of petered out. It didn't just stop like that. It kind of petered out. In the time of Achashverosh, when they wrote the Sitna, they wrote the damaging report, that was it. Nothing else. And that's why Achashverosh, when he tells Esther, he doesn't even know she's Jewish. But he says to her, you can have until half the kingdom, which the sages say means until the Beis HaMikdash. He didn't know that she was Jewish. But he made it a hallmark of his reign. He wanted it to be his legacy, that the Beis HaMikdash will not be rebuilt. I don't care what nation you come from, you cannot touch the Beis HaMikdash. It doesn't matter to me whether you're Jewish or whatever it is, you can't touch it. That was a big deal for Achashverosh. And so he was the one who set it in stone. It's not happening. But even before Achashverosh, it was certainly grinding to a halt. As I said, Rashi says it actually did stop before Achashverosh. Others say Achashverosh really stopped it. Yeah, go ahead.
So if that was his seal, so to speak, just because Esther said, the Jewish people are being killed and it's Haman who does it, you know, all of a sudden he went, oh, how horrible, let's not do that. What happened?
Well, you notice, he doesn't authorize the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash. He does authorize the Jews to fight back against Haman.
So what happened? He, you know, I mean...
Well, that's the whole Purim story, that she pulled it on, you know, it was all surprised him and shocked him. It was his wife who he really adored. I mean, that was the whole
that's why he changed his life.
That was the whole trick of the Purim story.
Love, passion.
Well, finding Haman lying on top of her didn't help.
Right. I mean, you know, I mean, he felt right. The whole story is arranged.
I just can't cite
right. That's why even at the very end, even after Esther accuses Haman, Achashverosh gets up and walks out. And then he comes back, and as was just pointed out, the angel pushes him on top of her. Because had the angel not done that, Achashverosh would not have necessarily killed Haman. And even after that, we need Charvona to speak up and say, oh, and not only that, but you know, he built this gallows for Mordecai, and Mordecai spoke good about the king, and the king in his wrath, he's just overcome with anger, he's lost his temper completely, he says, hang him! But without all those pieces coming together at the same time, he wouldn't have killed Haman.
And he had some drinks before.
And he was right. It was Hashem arranged it that Achashverosh was at the point where he would just lose it. But it wasn't a simple matter at all. And even after that, he did not authorize the building of the Beis HaMikdash. It was only after his death and his son takes over, then his son is the one who authorizes it. So it wasn't a simple matter at all. Achashverosh was not going to authorize the building of the Beis HaMikdash.
Well, so what was he afraid of? What was the Beis HaMikdash?
I don't know if it was...
So what was that the fear that he would not have the honor and glory and everything?
I don't know
why did he care what the Jews were doing in the first
place? So I don't know if it was fear or if it was simply not wanting God to be represented in the world. In the third year of his reign, he makes the party where he takes out the utensils of the Beis HaMikdash and he wears the clothing of the Kohen. I mean, he wants to show that God is not in control anymore.
Or that he's it,
right?
Except there's a lot of fear there.
It's either fear or just pure
egotism.
Yeah.
Is there anything in the Gemara that talks about why these powerful kings are so susceptible to their advisors, manipulation?
It doesn't, not that I know of. I don't know of any discussion about that. I mean, every king is going to be susceptible in some way. The only one who we read about so far who was really above all of that was Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar didn't deal with his advisors that way. We noticed that difference when we moved from Nebuchadnezzar to Belshazzar and Dariavish. As we moved down the line, we showed how the advisors become more and more significant. Well, Achashverosh, Nebuchadnezzar,
right,
yeah, he says, I'm going to wipe you all out. I don't need you.
Yeah,
I don't need any of you. I'm it. Right? So he really didn't need them. But as they move along, people need people. I mean, a king can't possibly run a country on his own. He's got to have He's got to have advisors. Some he trusts, some he doesn't.
And it's lonely at the top.
And it's lonely at the top. The kings that trusted the Jews, the ones that trusted Daniel, they succeeded. They were able to, because they had someone who wasn't going to kill them, right, and who was going to help them. And so they were very helped by that, which is why they always wanted a Jew around, mm-hmm. for that reason.
Still,
that's true. Even Achashverosh has the group of Jews that he consults with in the beginning of the story. Even he does. So now we have the letter that is going to be written to stop the work. Starting with Pasuk Zayin, verse 7, we're going to have a report of the letter. Now, as I said, there is a debate when the work actually stopped. Whether it was at the end of Koresh's reign or the beginning of Achashverosh's reign. So as a result, there is a debate who this letter is being written to, the one we're about to read. Some understand that we're about to read the Sitna, the damaging report that was sent to Achashverosh. That's what we're about to read about. Others understand that this was not the Sitna that was written to Achashverosh. Rather, this was a letter that was written to Koresh before Achashverosh. And then the letter that was written to Achashverosh is not reported, is not written verbatim here. So it's a debate what this is. Either way, it's a damaging report. And it was written to stop the work. So it says, we may Artachshasta, in the days of Artachshasta, which is a debate over who that is, whether this is Koresh or whether this is Achashverosh. The same debate I just told you about, it revolves around who this person is. He's the king, whoever it is. Kosav Bishlom Misridos Tovel Ushar Kinavosav. It was written, quote, with a piece of Misridas Tavel, that's a person's name. Rashi says he was an Egyptian. I'm sorry, no, excuse me, he was not Egyptian, I read that word wrong. He was one of the antagonists against Yehuda, and the rest of his group, the rest of his people, Al Artachshasta Melech Paras, on, this means to, a letter to Artachshasta, the king of Persia, Uchesav Anishtavan, and it was written, the letter was written, Kasuv Aramis, in Aramis, Aramaic words, Umisurgam Aramis, and it was, the letters were also Aramis. It was written in Aramaic letters and Aramaic words. It was a completely Aramaic letter. So, what does it say in that letter? It says, and we now move to Aramis. We move to Aramaic. Just like we had in parts of Sefer Daniel, we had Aramaic, we have it here as well. Rechum Baal Te'im V'Shimshai Safra. Rechum, that's the person's name. He was the Baal Te'im. Baal Te'im is a title. He was the writer. He was the one who knew how to write in an articulate way. Te'im means taste. He was able to write in a way that was not tasteful, but that you could understand what he was trying to write. He was a very articulate writer. The Shimshai Safra, and Shimshai who was the scribe. And Rashi says Shimshai was the son of Haman, one of the sons of Haman. So Rechum, the articulate one, and Shimshai, the scribe, Kisabu Igra Chada al Yerushalayim. They wrote a single letter regarding Yerushalayim, L'Artachshasta Malka Kinema, to the king Artachshasta Kinema as follows. Quote, Adayin Rechum Bel Te'im V'Shimshai Safra. Then Rechum, the articulate one, and Shimshai the scribe, Ushar Kinavason, and the rest of their group, Dinaye Va'afarsach, excuse me, Va'afarsas Chaye Tarpeloye Afarsoye, I should get a raise just for reading this. Akevoye vavloye shushanchoye dehave elmoye. Okay, that is the various groups of non-Jews who were there, who were, it's the names of various pagan gods that they worshipped, and all of those people, the people who were, it's like saying the Jews, you could say the Tarployes. Right. Usha'ar Umaya and the other nations, Dihagli Asnapar Rabba Viakira, that were exiled by Asnapar, the great and exalted one. Asnapar is another name for Sancheriv. That was Sancheriv's other name. He had many names, actually. So, those who were exiled by Sancheriv. Remember, the people living in Shomron were in exile. They were taken from their places and put in Shomron. So they were exiled by Sancheriv. Vahosev himo bikirya di Shomronin, and put them in the city of Shomron. Ushar avar nahara uchenes, and all the other places across the river. I forgot what that word means. Oh, and Canis, it's a place. Across the river means across the Euphrates. And across the Euphrates means Babylonia is on the east and north of the Euphrates, and Eretz Yisrael is on the south and west of the Euphrates. So when you cross the Euphrates, they were moved into Eretz Yisrael. So this is a letter from all these people who Sancheriv had put into the other side of the Euphrates. Dina parshegen igarta. This clear letter, Dishalachu Alohi al Artaxasta Malka, that was sent to Artaxasta the king, Avdach, from your servants, Enosh Avar Nahara, the people of the other side of the river, Uchanes and Chanes. And now, that was all the introduction, and now we'll get to the actual text of the letter. I want to point out to you that, I meant to mention this before in our introductory remarks, that Sancheriv is the one who put them there, but then when Sancheriv tried to attack Yerushalayim, his army was decimated, and eventually he was assassinated, and his son took over. So the person who was mentioned before, where are we here? The person in Pasuk, in Pasuk Beis, in verse 2, it says, from the days of Esarhaddon, the king of Assyria, Esarhaddon was one of the sons of Assyria, of Sancheriv. So he's the one who it was Sancheriv's command to put them there, but it was from the days of Esarhaddon that they claimed that they were worshipping Hashem. Yud Beis 12, Yediyah, Lehave Lamalka, it should be known to the king, Di Yehudaye Di Siliku Min Levasach, that the Jews who have come up from you, Alena Asol Yerushalem, they've come upon us in Yerushalayim, Kiryasa Maradta, it is a city of rebellion, Uvishta Banayin, and Vishta means an evil, they are building. They are building a city of rebellion and evil. Vishuraya, how do you read that? Shachlilu v'ushaya yachitu. And the wall, they have, the foundation they have laid, and the wall they are putting together. So they are putting together a city of rebellion and evil. Ka'an yediyah lehavei l'malka. It should be known to the king. Dihen kiryas adach tisbinei, that this city that is being built, v'shuraya yishtach l'lun, and that its foundation and its walls are being set up, Minda velo vahalach la yintanun, that from now on they will not give taxes. They will not pay the taxes. The apsom malchim tanzik, and to the taxes of the king they will damage. They are going to not pay, and they're going to damage the tax collecting of the king. Ka Ka'an, so you hit the king where it hurts, right? Financially, in the purse. Ka'an kol kavel di malach hechla melachna, that now, that as long as their sanctuary has been destroyed, the arvas malka la arich lana lemechazei, and the damage of the king we don't want to see. Until now, their sanctuary has been destroyed, and we don't want to see anything bad happen to the king. We want to protect you. Al dinash lechna behodana lemalka. On this, we are sending and making the king know. We want we're afraid for your well-being, king. We want to help you. Look into the chronicles, the historical chronicles of your ancestors, and you'll find in those books of the chronicles, this and that you will know. That this city, it is a rebellious city. Go look historically what the Jews did who were in Yerushalayim. Uman zikas malchin umidinon, and they were damaging to kings and to countries. Vesh tadur avdin bigava, and they did rebelliousness inside of it, inside this city. Minyomas alma, from the days of the world, and since its existence, from its inception. Al dinakiris hadach hacharavas, and that's why this city was destroyed, because it's a rebellious city against the kings, and that's why this city was destroyed. Mod ina nachna lemalka, we are letting the king know, dien kiris hadach tisbenei, that if this city is rebuilt, v'shuraya yishtachlulun, and its walls and its foundations are set, v'chavel dina chalok ba'avar nahara lo isai loch, that because of this you will not have a portion in the area beyond the Euphrates. They will take over all of the territory south and west of the Euphrates. They're going to take over your territory. Piskema shlach malka. Okay, that's it. That's the end of their letter. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now we get the response of the king, and we are really out of time. So we get the response of the king, which, as you know already, is going to be to stop the work, that he's going to agree with their words. So
their only proof is that the ancestors were bad in the chronicles.
That's the proof. I mean, they're saying that this is going to be terrible, and look back at the chronicles, right? So this doesn't mean to say that this was the only method that they used, but this is an example of what they were doing. They were speaking Lashon Hara. That's what they were doing. They were trying to, and they weren't speaking things that were totally false. They did pick up on some of the history that happened. There was friction between Yerushalayim and the ruling king, between Nebuchadnezzar. Remember how many times Nebuchadnezzar had to come back and conquer Yerushalayim, right? So there was what to draw from. So.
Yerushalayim consider it a city unto itself and a kingdom, so that they didn't feel that they had to pay taxes and had to honor the king of that area?
Well, when we lived in Yerushalayim, we were autonomous. It was only later that Nebuchadnezzar conquered Yerushalayim, and then there was trouble. He had to keep coming back and conquering again and conquering again and conquering again. So there was some truth to it. It wasn't that Yerushalayim was not paying their taxes for hundreds of years. They were only under the control of Nebuchadnezzar for 18 years before he destroyed the Beis Hamikdash. So whatever, you know, all that that happened.
Oh, very interesting.
So next time we'll start with his response, which is going to be negative, but then we're going to fast forward to the time that they come back after Achashverosh and after the son of Achashverosh and Esther takes over.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to torahmediaatlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.